You are a famous photographer. You work a lot for Vogue and Face, for instance. And I want to ask, why have you decided to make a film in this very strong team, a social team so strong as your first film as a director?
I think it came from the book that I did, Pony Kids, which is a book of photographs and a book of interviews that I did with the kids in the photographs, where I created a little bit of a narrative. And it was a book about Dublin's teenage horse culture. There was something that was very big in the mid to late 90s. A lot of the kids from the poor suburbs kept horses in the back garden or on the common ground. And there were no laws that they couldn't ride the horses through the middle of the city. Mm-hmm. But there became too many horses, and the government didn't like it, and they cracked down on it. And they introduced a license system, and they said you had to have a stable, and you had to have an acre of land in order to have a horse. Mm-hmm. So it kind of outlawed the horses. And I think when I'd done the book Pony Kids, I really felt like I wanted to look a bit further into the lives of one of these kids. And when I was doing the Pony Kids book, that's when I first met the travellers. Mm-hmm. Because obviously there's a horse fair in the middle of Dublin on the first Sunday of every month. Now it's dying out a little bit because it's being pushed out by the powers that be. But at the point that I was doing the photographs in the late 90s, every first Sunday of every month I would go there, set up a studio, mm-hmm. and choose people to be in the photographs, and then give them a Polaroid, and I'd keep the negative. And obviously there were a lot of travellers here. Traveller kids riding horses, traveller men, older men selling horses. And this is where I first came across them. But when I first wanted to do the film, it wasn't going to be about a traveller as such. It was more about a homeless, mm-hmm. a young kid who was homeless, and a kid who's growing up in a marginalised community. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to explore what it was like for one of these kids in the new prosperous Ireland, mm-hmm. because Ireland's gone through a sort of economic...
Now it's in the Europe...
It's been in Europe for a long time, but 20 years ago it had a third world economy. Mm-hmm. Now it's a wealthy economy.
In fact, in one of your declarations, you said that you follow, after the book, you follow the life of these boys, in particular in the court 55.
Yeah.
And I want to know why you have not choose to concentrate the main theme of the film in the the problems with the legality. But in fact, there is a scene very, very important in the jail. But this problem is not the main problem of your film.
You know, myself and my co-writer, Mark Venner, spent a lot of time in the court because mm-hmm. we felt that we went there a couple of times and realized that this is where everybody was from this. All the people in the court came from maybe four or five different areas in Dublin. Mm-hmm. And so it was just a wealth of stories, mm-hmm. and ideas, and just for us to learn about the margins. And at one point I wanted to do a documentary in the court, mm-hmm. but they wouldn't let us film in the court because of the kids being under 18 and all the restrictions and the paperwork involved in that. And then I had another idea to do a drama set in the court.
Yeah.
But we worked through all these ideas to get to the idea that we ended up with.
Yeah. The many characters of the film are members of the Morgan family. And why do you choose this particular group?
Because when we were in the court, one day, Paddy Mahon, mm-hmm. and one of the sisters, Mary Kate, came into court. And there'd been some altercation the night before where they live. I think some argument with the police. Okay. The police had come down late at night, maybe 2-3 in the morning, and there'd been a row, and I think Paddy had kicked the police car. Oh. And a little bit of a scuffle.
Yeah, yeah.
So the police took them in for the night, and then they appeared in court in the morning. Mm-hmm. So Mark and myself were sitting there watching, and in they come, and we thought an interesting story developed, and Paddy realized that the judge wasn't going to let him out straight away, that it would be fine for his sister to go. But he realized, oh, look, the judge isn't going with what the solicitor is saying. And he suddenly got up and pulled down his trousers and pulled up his sleeve and said, look at all the bruises from the police, what they've been doing to me. And we thought, wow, he can make a performance. So we thought we must try and find out who, we knew the name and you find the address in the court. And so 2 days later, I rang up one of the policemen who I'd become friends with in the court. And he said, oh yes, he was let out the next day and he's... So we went down to see him and I showed him the Pony Kids book and said I was researching for a film and would he be interested and could we speak to him and could we hang out with him, and he was very keen. So and then through him we met Winnie, the rest of the family, but in particular Winnie. And when I met Winnie, she was just at an age where there was such an innocence. She was just sort of, a child still, pre-puberty. Even though she was much more grown up than her age, at the age of 10, she was more like 13, 14, 15. And I just did some filming with Winnie, and I realized that the camera loved her. She's just one of those, it's hard to explain who the camera does and doesn't love, but that it just works. And she had such a wonderful spirit, and she was so curious.
Yeah.
And I just realized that she had to become the main character.
Yeah. In fact, I noticed she is very curious and clever, but maybe in the film we can see that she has not a great education. She goes not to school, and she seems the younger sister of Rosetta. Do you find she will be more and more similar to this character growing up?
To Rosetta?
Yeah.
Could be. I think that the similarities with Rosetta and Winnie when she's older will be that in the same way it will be hard for her to get a job.
Yeah, exactly.
And like her sister, who's now 16, is trying to get a job and trying to do this and trying to get a house. And it's a struggle. Rosetta is a film that I love very much. And in some ways we were thinking this is a pre-Rosetta story, the younger, a younger girl.
And I want to ask now, how do you work with people that is partly composed by actors and non-actors, like...
Obviously a lot of it is in the casting, trying to find people that you feel will be incredibly natural in front of the camera and not self-conscious at all. And sometimes you can see that, you can find that sometimes very easily. Mm-hmm. And you very easily know who isn't going to work. And then you just work with them, and we shot a lot of film. Because we were shooting on mini DV, we were able to shoot a lot of film. And so you can have a lot of wastage. And I think that everybody was learning as they went. It was my first film as well. And I was learning. I think everybody was learning. And I think that we found a little method. And, initially to Winnie, my main thing, because she was such a natural, was the camera's not here. So you have to create a little bit of a very small team filming. Yeah. And create situations that she can believe. So that she very quickly slips into this is the reality of the moment, and I think each natural. Ultimately each person you work with is slightly different, so you have to find ways for them to believe what they're doing, so that they become less and less aware of the camera being there. And for me, it was important too that nobody was performing, but people are being, because I think that performing, I didn't want a performance from anybody. And so even with the actors and actresses that we had, it was important that they were going to have this naturalism, because otherwise they would be performing and the other people would be being, and you have a clash of two different styles.
Yes. You are also the director of photography of the film, and so that is the reason why you choose to use the DV camera that gives a rough aspect to the image.
If I go back to the very beginning, I definitely considered trying to get a DP and who I would get if I had all the money in the world. But at the end of the day, I realized it was going to be made in such a way that it wouldn't be 6 week shooting, 8 week shooting. It was going to be made over a period of time. Mm-hmm. And so that would be very difficult to get a good DP to commit to this way of working. And then I also realized, and secondly, I didn't want to really let go of the composing of the frame to anybody else, really, at the end of the day. It would have been crazy. And thirdly, I felt that if I was doing that and directing, then it would be a much more intimate way to work and get much more of a sort of intimate intimate performances, mm-hmm. though not performances, from the people. Whereas if there'd been a cameraman, a director, and
it's
too much distraction for them. And I think that again with video, I knew all along, okay, I shoot on mini DV and then I blow up to 35mm, and this should create a certain kind of texture, rough texture, mm-hmm. that echoes the way they live, where they're living. Mm.
In the first scene of the film, we see an old woman who, by reading the hand of the young Willy, introduced the main narrative elements of the film, marriage, school, and I want to ask, how have you conjugated the different elements, the narrative and the documentary elements of the film, and also what represent this character, the old woman?
With the first question, in the beginning we were trying to make a non-narrative film, maybe something that was more poetic, more just driven by images. But it's very hard to make a non-narrative film because it's very hard to keep your audience. So I think we ended up with something that's by no means traditional, but it has threads of narrative, these little stories that are, like you say, this desire to get married, this intrigue with marriage and some sense of escaping from the home, the school. And I think we were happy with that. We think it works like that. And then going back to the old woman, she was just meant to be a fortune teller that Winnie had gone to see. Mm. And she doesn't really represent anything beyond that.
Okay, she lives there in the community.
She's another traveller woman, but in another place. It's not her grandmother or anything in particular. Mm-hmm. It's just a woman she sees, and we just thought it was a nice kind of prologue to the film.
In her struggle in the fight to research her identity, Winnie is attracted by the city and what the city represents. And I want to know if there is a role in the non-Irish clerks that work in the shops she visits.
I think the idea of that was that there's a bit of a cliche, which is the travellers and the settled people, and the settled people not letting the travellers into their way of life. Mm-hmm. But we decided we didn't want to go with that because it's known, it's been done before. But what was much more interesting was how the new people who've come to Ireland in the last 5-8 years, Africans, Chinese, Eastern Europeans, Russians, they don't know a traveller from a settled person in the beginning. Mm-mm. That people are just people. So they're more welcoming to Winnie. And so Winnie finds herself in these places where she's being welcomed.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. But because I don't know what the traveller represent in Irish tradition, so I...
You see, other settled Irish people would be very wary, mm-hmm. of travellers, mm-hmm. because travellers have a reputation for crime and violence and But you know, we're trying to explore what it is like to be the 10-year-old traveler girl who has all these forces acting on her, and she's only learning about them.
They are different from gypsies, so maybe
they're not Romani gypsies. Yeah.
Okay. They have a culture, because the title of the film is very strange, and also when you ask people talk, you can't understand very well the language, so maybe.
But they have a very strong accent, and sometimes they use words from cant and gammon. Mm-hmm. They have their own language, which is like a secret language, a lot of which is words turned around.
Code.
Yeah, it's like a little code. It doesn't come from another language, I don't think. It's just they've made it up themselves.
And Winnie seems to be to be at the opposite side of her mother. The mother is a proud Pavi woman, and Winnie. Do you think that the conflict is a thing who is joined to the young generations, or maybe to this particular family, because maybe young generations want to integrate the society more than.
I think that what's happened with travel, I mean, it's hard to generalize because there are a lot of travelers, and some are wealthy, and many are poor, and many live by the side of the road all over Ireland. Some now live in houses, some even live in big houses. And but you know, there are few travellers who really get into mainstream society. There are very few who are lawyers or doctors or playwrights or have these kind of jobs. And I think that what's happened is that Ireland has changed a lot in the last 20, 30 years from being very sort of it was poor. It was really a poor country, and it was a country that had stood still in time. It hadn't sort of been modernized. People were still going around Dublin in the early 80s, you know, delivering things with horse and cart. And I think that there was a time when the travelers, a lot of travelers did things like make, you know, they were tinsmiths, and they were called tinkers because of this. But there came a point where there's no room for this. You can't make a living doing this. And so I think that's one of the big changes in the last 20 or 30 years, is the little crafts and things that they did can no longer exist. And also drugs have come in. You know, they used to frown on drugs, the idea of heroin.
We saw the girl who's
the petrol sniffing, and now drugs have really come into the traveler world and caused havoc. And I think the idea of, you know, there is this idea in the younger kids that they would love to get a house or a flat because there would be water, there would be toilets, you could have a bath, you could have a shower, you could clean your clothes. So all these things, I think there is a desire for that. And I met quite a lot of travellers when I was doing this, and there seems to be a myth that travellers want to travel. But I actually think now that quite a lot of them would be happy to stay still and to have all those things that can make your life a little bit easier.
Yes, music is very important in the film, but always is inside the film. We see when Winnie sings, and also when she plays the steps game. Why do you use the music of just at the end of the film, when the tension is at the top of the story?
I think the plan was always to use music that came from within the film, and not to have extra diegetic music. And so in the beginning, when I found this track to play at the end, and I thought it was because we're changing the style of filmmaking in a way, because we're stopping. We've always been following. The camera's always slowly been following Winnie. Yeah. But once she's got the water and the girl and they walk back, we stop and we hold still. And so it's a point of disengagement. We're going back to our life, she's going back to her life. And for me, it meant that the music didn't have to strictly adhere to the previous rule that everything came from within the shop, or when they turn on the tape, or standing outside a shop and the music is coming from within. To me it seemed to work. It seemed to mean you can break this rule now. Not everything has to be from inside. You can do one at the end. And it seemed to accentuate the fact that we're stepping away now.
Yeah, it's true. I have the impression.
Yeah, you got that feeling at the
Further than the Darden brother, have you maybe other source of inspiration for this film?
I'm a great fan of all social realist films, every kind of school, from the, you know, the Italian neorealists. Obviously looked at a lot of the De Sica films, the Rossellini films, the early ones, Pasolini, Acatoni, Ken Loach, of course. There were films, there were some particular films. There was a film called Streetwise, a documentary by Martin Bell about homeless kids in Seattle. And his partner, Mary Ellen Mark, the photographer, had done a series of pictures for Life magazine, I think at the end of the 70s, about these kids. And they'd gone back and then made this documentary that you can get on video in the States, but it's a hard one to find. And this is a film that I showed to my co-writer Mark in the very beginning, saying, because it's a documentary that doesn't have voiceover, it's sort of, it's live action in a way, but it is still very much a documentary. And that one sort of mixed with Los Olvidados is a film I've always loved. I first saw it many, many years ago. And I always have just loved it. And who else than the English director, Alan Clark, whose work I didn't... He made these films in the 80s. He'd been a director mainly for TV. You know, the great tradition of in Britain of making TV drama that started in the 60s. Ken Loach, too, did this thing, the Wednesday play. And by the time it got to the 80s, Alan Clark had really refined his way of filmmaking. And he had found a way of draining the narrative, traditional narrative, from these pieces to such an extent that the film Elephant has one line of dialogue in 40 minutes. And I miss them at the time, but I saw them later, and I used to go to the BFI to watch them all. And there was one film in particular, Christine, about a young girl who goes around a housing estate, sort of lower middle class housing estate, with a bag of heroin, and going to her friends, and they take it, but they don't talk about it. It's just something they do. And the way it's written is that there's no plot. There's no real narrative. And I ended up going there and transcribing the whole film and typing it up and making the script so that myself and Mark could see how did they do that? You know, what does this script look like? So there were, we did a lot of these things. It was part of the learning process of how to do this and how to craft a film in this kind of way. So he was a huge influence, Alan Clark. And also the style in which it's shot, he was one of the first people to be using Steadicam. And he just follows the characters. In Christine, he's following them. In the Elephant, he's just following the characters all the time. But he's not drawing attention to the camera. He's not making a statement. He is somehow reinforcing that person.
Yes, also see in your film, you follow her.
Yeah, so that style is very much inspired by Christine Elephant. It's just quietly following.
Slowly.
Trying not to. There's some shots I'd like to do again, but you know. It's meant to just reveal things in that way.
My last question. Have you idea for a new movie as a director, or maybe a new project as a photographer, like your best, your beautiful picture in Francis Bacon's studio?
Oh, yeah. At the moment, I'm trying to work to the end of this year on this film, to because there are many festivals to have to go to and things.
Yes, to go to Toronto.
Toronto and London and Thessalonica are the next ones. I do have some ideas. I have that I don't want to talk about too much because it's very early, and I need to. In January, I'm going to start and spend 2 or 3 months just to see if this idea. It's something that's set in the Caribbean, mm-hmm. so quite different setting. Although I've always thought that Ireland is a kind of European Caribbean. So I'm going to go for a couple of months and just see if the ideas and the images that I have, because I've spent a lot of time there already,
yeah.
could actually, if it's all there, and then decide, yeah.
Okay, but in the past you have a great opportunity to work in the study of Francis Bacon.
Yeah.
The album is very beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, the Francis Bacon. I tried to interview Francis Bacon when I was doing a magazine in school, when I was 17, 18. And I'd never been able to make contact. And in fact, I went to interview Andy Warhol in New York instead and to photograph Andy Warhol because I wanted an interview with a painter. And they were the two ones that I was familiar with, whose work I knew and whose work I was drawn to. And so 20 years later, I was asked by the museum in Dublin if I would come and take the photographs of the studio, because the Francis Bacon estate was giving the studio to the museum.
Ah, yes, I saw.
And and the reason I developed a relationship with the museum is because they had the exhibition of Pony Kids. And so the director knew that I had a great love and fascination with Bacon. Mm-hmm. And it was a wonderful project. And in the beginning, it was just me in the studio alone photographing for a few days.
You were free to photograph?
Yeah. I didn't move anything. But I was free to take photographs in the space.
Okay.
And so I think I went 3 times to the studio. And I always went in the morning because he had a studio with one skylight facing west. And he would always paint in the morning. Yeah. He would get up very early. And so the paint would always be like north light, even though it was facing west, because the sun would never go round until the afternoon to the west. So it was important for me that I was photographing it in the same atmosphere within which he would work.